It is Tuesday, August 14th, 2012. I am Steve Gerwick, the webmaster of www.gerweck.net, gerwick.net, your source on the World Wide Web for all your pro wrestling news since 1997. And right now, it's an honor and a pleasure to welcome the whole effing show to gerwick.net, Rob Van Dam. How you doing, RVD?
I'm doing excellent, Steve. Thanks for asking. It's okay to go ahead and assume that RVD is doing excellent, though.
I was going to do that, but it's always nice to ask every now and then, too.
Yeah, but we'll just make that the policy for everybody listening to you from now on. Just go ahead and assume RVD is doing excellent. Things are good when you're RVD.
Well, everything was really good on Sunday. Of course, you competed in the Hardcore Justice pay-per-view. You're in the Bound for Glory series, False Count Anywhere. On Sunday, you defeated the Pope, Magnus, and Mr. Anderson. A great match. I want to congratulate you on the victory.
Thanks, you
just continue on. Some people get better with age, and I watch you, and I've been watching you for so long, and your matches are still so great. So how do you do it, Rob? How does Rob Van Dam continue to grow and to be so great in the ring and to be such a great competitor these days?
I'm just consistent, and I've always been extreme, which by my definition I'll say is to push the limits. So back in the day, like in let's say 97, 98, when I really kind of exploded and really learned how to put everything together to put me on a whole new level, like a superstar status, which I would go back to say when I beat Bam Bam Bigelow for the ECW television title. That's when it really, for me, was so obvious. I was on the crowd, everybody treated me different after that particular match. Like before that, it was good, but I mean, all of a sudden, I wrestled Mikey Whipwreck the day after, and I told Paul Heyman, dude, I got this idea. I want to jump over both guardrails, do this leg up. He goes, I don't think it matters what you do. The people are going to love you. And he was right, and it's been like that ever since. So I still do the moves that were way ahead of everybody else back like in 98, but they're still way ahead of everybody else. Nobody else is doing a jumping, spinning leg drop off the apron to the guardrail, because it would kill most people, most wrestlers. They couldn't take that kind of punishment. And I like to challenge myself. So, yeah, I still come up with some stuff now and then, but mostly it's the parameters that I'm put in. I'm a show off. If you let me go, I'm going to go. Hardcore Justice, by the way, was one of those matches where they kind of let you go. I mean, you always have time limit, and you know, if there's three people, then that's a little more of a compromise of what even than with one person, as far as like as far as everything, the amount of time, the amount of spotlights on you, everything. So it was a False Count Anywhere match, so that's where somebody like RVD shines, because I can take a lot more punishment than most guys. So we went all over the place: chairs, guardrail, up on the stage. Boom, all that. And as you mentioned, RVD was victorious.
Absolutely, of course. Of course, the Bound for Glory series continues now into October with the Bound for Glory's pay-per-view. And, of course, whoever wins the Bound for Glory series goes on and take on the champion. I assume it's going to be Rob Van Dam. So if Rob Van Dam is the winner of the Bound for Glory series, who would you like to face at Bound for Glory for the TNA championship?
Now, that's a good question. You know, I'm going to go with, the guy that I would have the best match with that I can see as a potential candidate. I don't even know who's pulling ahead. I know I'm doing well in the tournament. I don't know who else is doing well. I haven't been keeping track of who's losing points or gaining points. But I know RVD versus Jeff Hardy is one of the best matches that we could possibly hope for, and especially if we had like a big time limit. I have fans all the time come up to me and tell me that Jeff Hardy and RVD Invasion 2001, when I first came into WWE, fought for the Hardcore title. That's still one of their favorite matches. And today, if we still had the freedom and the time limit, I mean, we would still give everything that we gave back then. It's always with we're like-minded in that way, as far as like what we want, what we got to show, what we want to show, the sacrifice of our of our body and what we think is cool in a match, you know. So I'd like to wrestle Jeff. That'd be awesome. And it's always about the limits. It's always about, you know, how much time you have or what you can do. You know, for instance, they don't really like you to fly over the guardrail because you can take a fan out and then there's a liability down there at Universal Studios or wherever it is. This is actually going to be in Phoenix, Arizona. But that used to happen with ECW, by the way. There were some lawsuits. I'm surprised it didn't happen a hell of a lot more.
What's your thoughts on the Bound for Glory series itself, the concept of it, and obviously the culmination of the pay-per-view, the biggest pay-per-view of the year for TNA, of course, the Bound for Glory pay-per-view. What do you think of the concept of the series overall?
I think it's, as a competitor, I think it's exciting because every week as we're going towards the tournament for several months, our matches every night have more depth to them. There's more... they mean more. There's more validity to what's going on. I mean, you're not just on the road knocking out dates on the calendar. You're actually working towards this goal that's like starts in the summer sometime, and it all accumulates, you know, for this one big, huge show that happens to be TNA's biggest pay-per-view all year. I was at a show in Maryland a couple weeks ago, and I wrestled Kurt Angle. And then I wasn't on TV, but I wasn't even sure going into that. And then they told me that was part of the tournament, you know. So it's like, for me, that means a lot. I was off TV, and I'm thinking, wow, I'm not going to have any points towards this tournament. Everyone's going to get ahead of me. But boom, I'm back in the game. And so it's a really big deal. And this will be my third Bound for Glory pay-per-view. The first one I did, I wrestled Abyss in Daytona, which was one of my favorite matches that I've had in TNA because, as I keep saying, they just let me go. I mean, it was barbed wire. It was tables and chairs and everything that we had, and it was, you know, some bruising, some bleeding, and for me, you know, that's me giving it my all because I got that much. The next year, Jerry Lynn, same kind of thing. It was like they call it a metal mayhem match or something crazy like that. But anyway, that's pretty much what it meant for us was it's a go. Everything is okay here. Extreme rules. And Jerry and I both like it that way as well. So going into this, I've got a pretty good record of Bound for Glories going into this. Two of them, Mr. Pay-Per-View. This will be my third one. So don't know who I'm going to wrestle, but I got high expectations.
What's the morale like in TNA right now? Obviously, we found out this summer that Spike TV was going to give Impact Wrestling a live TV slot through the summer, and Dixie just confirmed that you're going to be live through September. What's the morale like right now? Obviously, the ratings itself have kind of held into a regular range of about 1.0, you know, pretty consistently. So, overall, how would you describe the morale in the locker room?
Everybody seems to really get along in such a way that there's like an absence of the nervousness that I used to witness working for the other guys. I mean, it was everywhere. House shows, TV was way more tense, and then international tours. Oh my God, you're on the bus with everybody, and you see every stage of the feeding chain, yeah, the pecking order. It's like if some young guys are too comfortable because they're joking and actually having a good time, oh, you watch them get put in their place because it just by a look, it'll start by some of the other guys just giving them a look, and then afterwards they got to figure out how to follow up and start riding that guy hard because he shouldn't be that comfortable because he hasn't paid his dues. And it just up there, it just reeked of that, and I didn't put it over, but then I've always, you know, kind of been the one of a kind, and that's also what kind of made me not fit in that much, because I thought all that was just ridiculous. I mean, it has its necessities, I guess, like a fraternity, and it is the business, and I mean, obviously, I pay my dues and earn my respect, but point is, the nervousness, the tension, that you get everywhere that you see up there, everyone afraid of saying the wrong thing or getting heat. I don't see that in TNA. I see a bunch of guys that get along, that, you know, kind of want to see each other do well. Everyone, you know, has the sense to look out for themselves with business. You got a combination of guys that are loyal to the company, and they expect some return energy, some return love from the office for being so loyal. And then you also have guys that are really, really more marketable than other guys, and that's an aspect of the business. And you see guys dealing with that. But most of all, there's a lot of love there. There's a lot of guys joke around. They genuinely seem happy to see each other when they get to work and say hello. And I think doing these shows live adds a bit of excitement to the air as well, because people are watching us right now at the moment, you know. So you know that what you're doing is your only chance. You know, if you get injured or whatever, your family, your friends, everybody that's watching it is seeing that happen. That's exciting.
How has things changed from a creative standpoint? Obviously, Vince Russo was basically the head writer for TNA for almost from the inception of the company, and of course, he was recently replaced with Bruce Pritchard. How has the creative process changed in TNA? Do you have a lot of input in terms of your direction or your storyline? Do the guys have input, or is it kind of whatever Bruce says and the booking committee?
I believe that depending on how much leverage you probably deserve, as far as being one of the talent, I think that you have as much input as you want. And me personally, the last thing that I want is to sit in on any kind of meetings and figure out direction of what we're going to do and this and that. That's not what I'm in it for. That's not what I enjoy about pro wrestling. It is a job for me. It's a good job. But if it was up to me, I would report to work 5 minutes before the bell and then go wrestle, take a shower, and get out of there. And basically, that's almost what I do, except for I usually do stretch on the clock.
What was the reaction when Brooke Hogan was brought in to be the executive of the Knockouts division?
I think people were surprised to see Brooke brought in, you know, but I think a lot of people respect Hulk enough to respect his family, you know, and his guests, you know, whoever he is. So you see a lot of that. I don't know what her position is with the Knockouts. I'm not sure if that's clear with anybody. I mean, she's definitely been attached to that division of the company. I don't know if it's on the front, like as a face to put on there, or if she's actually got, you know, some creative direction or what. I have no idea. I don't know her that well, or know, you know, what her interests or abilities are, and I haven't seen any kind of a reaction really that's really that noteworthy, other than a bit of surprise by everybody.
Can you? I don't know if you can speak to this or not, but just recently, Angelina Love has left the company. Velvet Sky is gone, and now we're hearing Winter is leaving too. So, can you speak to what the rash of losses in terms of Knockouts are to the roster right now in TNA?
It's not that I'm holding back from speaking, but I really know very little about that.
Okay.
One of the names you mentioned is going to be coming back, I believe, I've been told. But I don't know. It seems like the Knockouts aren't as big of a part of the show as they used to be, it seems like. And when I first got there, sometimes it seemed like that. Didn't they even have, like, their own pay-per-view at one point? It seems like they did, where it was all Knockout matches. I don't know. But anyway, it seemed like it was a bigger part of the show, and now it seems like maybe not so much. And I guess that would have... If that is the case, that would have something to do with trimming down and having less girls, I guess, you know. But
right.
I wouldn't imagine that that they would be cut. It would definitely have nothing to do with their talent, because they were all very good. And now, Miss Tessmacher, she's got the belt. I think that's a great idea. The crowd really gets behind her. And I don't know. She's got to have opponents too. So I don't know, like, who's just at home waiting for the call, and who's let go. I don't even know.
Yeah. I want to ask you about working for Dixie Carter. Obviously, you've worked for a lot of different promoters. Obviously, the ones that come to mind are, of course, Paul Heyman and Vince McMahon. How is she to work for? I got to believe she's a little more laid back than, say, Heyman and Mr. McMahon.
For sure, you know, and I can compare all of them, but also, to be fair, I have to point out what a different stage in my career I'm at with all of them. With Dixie, I mean, I have all the freedom and the leverage in the world. I love my deal that I have with TNA. So if you ever hear me about me complaining, it's going to be bullshit, because I love my deal at TNA. Dixie's great, and I never get anything but props for every match, every night. They let me know they're happy for me being there, and that goes a long way, you know. In WWE, you know, I mean, with Vince in particular that you're asking about, he's very respectable. You know, you can't help but respect the guy. He's the Donald Trump of pro wrestling. You know what I mean? He is the standard setter, and he, you know, you have to be a little crazy and have to have a huge ego, I think, to be in that position. And to create your whole entire world around you that's yours as far as you can see, including your family and everything. He always just treated me with respect one-on-one. He you know, always gave me the time whenever I did have something I needed to talk to him about, which was, not too often. And, with Paul Heyman, Paul gave me and Sabu tons of freedom. Tons of freedom, and he helped obviously tailor me into being the superstar that I would be. He's great at pulling out people's strengths and working around weaknesses. And when I went to ECW, I had no idea until I heard that Taz said in an interview one time that he thought RVD was probably the most gifted athlete in the business. Prior to that, that thought never went into my head at all. So that really fueled me to start, you know, really trying to step it up. And with Paul's tutelage, but also freedom, I was able to grow and expand into what I would. He would actually have meetings for the entire dressing room, and he would tell me and Sabu beforehand, he would say, I'm going to tell everybody that this is mandatory, that everybody needs to be there, but you guys don't need to worry about it. So he always made me and Sabu feel like we were on a total different level than the rest of the company. And besides that, you know, I mean, as far as in the ring, I never, with ECW, ever had a time limit, ever. Even on the most tense programs where it's pay-per-view and every minute is being paid for and budgeted for, he would just say, go out there and steal the show. So I would. It's working for them, that's the best way that I could explain it. Paul is still one of my good friends and the only agent when I was in WWE, if you could call him that, that ever had my best interests in mind. But there was definitely pros, positives, big benefits for working for all three. And for wrestlers that haven't done that, or to just stay with one company, even if it's a really small one, and they think that they can just stay loyal and that's going to pay off for them, they're actually not really being as loyal to themselves as they need to be, because they need to be selfish enough to get themselves well-rounded, because then they'll be worth more. But also, their work will be adaptable more, because the styles do change from going down south to going northeast to going Japan to going an extreme backyard to the WWE. I mean, everything in between is necessary to get the well-rounded talent, and if you can survive all of that, then you might have a shot. So I, you know, of course, people aren't going to have a chance to work for ECW again. But point being, you know, you should have more than one boss if you want to consider yourself experienced.
Now this is a two-part question. Obviously, you've been in the business for a long time, and I know wrestlers, even from a earlier career, they think about retirement when they may, you know, decide to eventually walk away from the ring. Have you thought about retirement in your case in terms of how many more years you want to be active in the ring? And is there a possibility, part two, that you would end your career with TNA, or do you envision possibly another return to WWE?
Well, I don't put a lot of thought into retiring yet, so much as a lot of my other interests are gaining more and more of my energy, and I feel like it's going to be a natural transition. I'm involved with so many different projects, and I seem to need that in order for my brain to function. Before I was a pro wrestler, I actually had a lot of potential to do whatever I wanted. I was actually a very intelligent student in school, and I consider myself a writer, or more so a creator. And I don't ever want to be a suit and tie in pro wrestling, trying to create wrestling storylines and programs that affect the livelihoods of the boys. That's not something that I have any interest in or passion. So that's something that, you know, again, keeps me out of the loop and mostly in my car until I have to get to the ring and back and then right back out to my car. But I do have several writing projects. I have production projects. I have merchandising projects, and I have a ton of stuff. I just some of my projects have been going for 10 years. Some of them are brand new. I have all kinds of possible projects with different people. My website, robvandam.com, I spend a lot of time trying to always get that updated to keep people up with my status. And we just added RVD Productions, where I have some of my projects on there that are at the stage where I can talk about them a little bit, and also some other projects that I'm not really talking about yet, but I have placeholders for those on there. And that's something, you know, that there's a lot of stuff that I really like to do besides wrestling, and wrestling, even with the lighter schedule that I have with TNA, which is a much, much better schedule, it's still very consuming, and it's still a full-time job keeping in shape and condition to be able to do what I do. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about retiring, but, I mean, after 20, I don't know, I started like in 89, had my first matches in 90 after schooling and meeting the Sheik in 89. So it's been a long time. I don't know. You know, will I be doing it in 10 years? No, I mean, not. There's no way. I'm not going to be doing a three-star frog splash for my finish. So far, physically, I can still do everything I ever could do. And if I have any question about it, or if I just feel like doing it, just to keep it in practice, I'll do it. A couple of weeks ago, I went up to the top rope at TNA Impact in a match with Jeff Hardy, and I jumped off the top rope and did a 450 splash and ate the canvas. And afterwards, Christopher Daniels was saying, "Dude, a 450!" I'm like, "Yeah." And he goes, "Because I'm like, yeah, whatever, I can do that." And he's like, "How long has it been since you did that?" And I'm like, and I thought about it. I'm like, "Whew, at least 10 years." But sometimes I do that just because, you know, I stretch, I keep at the top of my game, and then sometimes, you know, you have to actually do moves in actuality, not just in your mind. But as long as I'm doing that, I'm still able to do everything, and I'm, you know, it's a good job. I make good money doing what I do, and there's a lot of benefits to being on TV. It wouldn't be a good time to walk away unless I wanted to, unless there was a reason that I wanted to walk away from it. I mean, I do believe in going out on top is good, but right now I'm coming close, I guess, not real close, not close enough to where we need to start, you know, talking, but I signed a 3-year deal with those guys, and it's been, 2.5-ish years There's always rumors, you know, that my contract's up, when it wasn't. In fact, I've been with them. But soon, I guess, you know, we'll cross that bridge if I'm going to stay with them or not. Do I think I'd retire with them? I don't know. I mean, I would have to think that I would still have, you know, want to do some international tours or something if I was going to not stay with them, after, you know, in the near future. And as far as your question about would I consider another WWE run, it would just be all about business, you know. So anything is possible, although I can't imagine for the life of me committing to the schedule that I was on previously with WWE. I really, really doubt that that would even be appealing with all kinds of zeros behind that number.
Maybe, you know, we've seen certain wrestlers get limited deals in terms of how many dates you'd have to work. If they were to offer you maybe a limited schedule, would that be something that may...
You know, I actually talked to WWE about having a limited schedule before I signed with TNA, and their response to that was that they would love to have me back. Please reconsider the schedule. We need you here full time so we can use you right, which I wasn't interested in. Now, 3 years later, I'm even less interested than I was then, which was not interested at all. It's a really rough grind. If you really love what you're doing and you love those wrestlers enough to have them be your only family, and you can't get enough of seeing those guys change clothes in the dressing room, and that can be great for you every day of the year. But for myself, I can't imagine a limited schedule. If the company was in such a position that would be something that they would want to do, then we would talk. But my ego's nowhere near big enough to make me, you know, for me to tell you that I'm as big of a star as Brock Lesnar or The Rock or Steve Austin. I mean, those guys have been used and pushed as main eventers way harder than RVD ever has. So that's something that I don't see as being, quite as probable as a lot of the fans wish it to be.
You know, I know a lot of people in wrestling, and I've got to say that you are probably one of the nicest people I've ever met. I don't know if you probably don't remember this. This was years ago when you were in ECW. I was going to the shows all the time, house shows, TV tapings in Toledo, Detroit, Dearborn areas. And I remember this one time I was just standing there, I was talking to a colleague, and you just came over and you introduced yourself to me. And since then, I always thought you were like one of the most approachable people, one of the nicest down-to-earth people. You know, I've talked to other people that have known you. They always say good things about you. So it is a pleasure to talk to you today. And it's been a long time since I've talked to you, obviously. Those go back to the ECW days. But
I appreciate that. That's, you know, I get a lot of good energy from hearing that. Being genuine is one of the higher priorities for me. So I hear that I come across that way to people that haven't met me a lot, you know, and it's like, and it's obvious sometimes when people pass me, could be in an airport or any city, anywhere, and a lot of times their reaction will be to, you know, be real excited and come up and want to shake my hand and all that. Other, just as often, it seems like, is these people that just act like they know me. They just walk by, RVD! You know, like there's someone that I see every day, like we're in school together or something, and I get quite a bit of that, too. So that's cool.
Yeah,
appreciate that.
They're doing the thumbs, and they know it's RVDs.
Yeah, but they're like, ah, he's cool, I'm cool, it's all good. They just want to walk by and just give me props.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, I was thinking about the ECW days, and of course, I think that was one of the best periods in wrestling was 98, 99, that period when ECW was running along. And of course we had WWF and WCW also running at the same time. But I just wondered, you know, reflecting on those ECW days, what do you kind of miss most about the Paul Heyman ECW?
Okay, what I miss most about the Paul Heyman ECW was the energy that I could feel from shocking the crowd on a nightly basis. Yesterday I was reading my Twitter comments, and I read one comment that somebody said about me, and I don't know if they meant it as a compliment or not, but they just, for whatever reason, their message they put on there was, they said I could never get into the real RVD, because that's my Twitter name. And he said, I always thought somebody was going to die during his matches. And I don't know why, but I took that as a compliment, you know, because I'm out there and it's important for me as a performer getting paid to show what I've got. I would like not only every fan in the crowd, but most of the wrestlers in the back to know also that they wouldn't survive what I do on a nightly basis, because that's what I need, you know, as a show off. That's what I crave. I think that's what entertainers in general are trying to do, is get that energy that they're aiming for, you know, by what they're putting out there. They're aiming for a return, and that's my return. And when Paul Heyman was running ECW, I could go out there and no matter what I thought was appropriate, it was worth giving it a try. If I thought, you know what, I want to shoot myself out of a cannon and have you just bat me like a baseball with a chair, you know, Paul would have said, let's do it. It was just, I mean, he had the sense, you know, not to let everybody do whatever they want, because not everything was appropriate. But for me, I was challenging myself, discovering, you know, what I could do. And at the same time, the fans were loving me for it. So, you know, that was just awesome.
Now, you were talking before about the invasion period, you know, in WWE, or it would have been WWF at the time, with ECW, WCW. Now, of course, I thought that invasion angle that they did was gaining a lot of steam, was going to be one that was going to run for, I think, had the potential of running for quite a long time, yet they had the one invasion pay-per-view, and they kind of blew it off. Why? And, you know, looking back at that period, why don't you think that invasion angle really worked or went further than it did?
Because I think any program like that is done by Vince with the goal of destroying it. I think that was the whole reason for everything that he's done, is to bring it up, stand on it, and say, I am king. So I think from the get-go, it only had a limited amount. You know, when we came back with bringing ECW back, we're bringing it back as a third brand. He's investing all this money and time into a third worldwide brand, and yet he introduces it on Raw as heels, and has me and Sabu and Sandman and Balls Mahoney like jump John Cena and do all these, you know, things that are considered bad guy things, when you four people jump in a ring and beat up one guy, you know, after his match or whatever, we come down from the crowd or whatever. How's that going to promote, you know, okay, we got our own spinoff, check us out? No, they boo. That was the WWE crowd. I mean, he just, unless he thought that just the few hardcores from there would say, yeah, I'm going with them, screw this Raw, that's never the case. All wrestling fans are going to watch all the shows. You're not going to get them to alienate the biggest product and leave with us, and that'd be ridiculous anyway, because you'd be working with a small, you know, a small cult of a crowd. So that's my answer. I think everything that he brings out is so he can stand over it, make himself champion of it, and then sweep it away.
And it was your idea, wasn't it, to bring back ECW as part of the WWE brand?
Well, yes and no. It was my idea to bring him back, and we did my idea to do One Night Stand, and that was such a success that became an annual pay-per-view. When they talked about bringing it back as a third brand, all I had been doing was trying to get Vince to understand how much love and energy there was involved with this that wouldn't die, and how offering like an extreme, you know, alternate version that's different than what you have, you know, would be great, and this is the way to do it. I didn't actually expect for it to come out, you know, like, okay, now we got Raw, SmackDown, and ECW. That was just way better than I could have dreamed. And at first, they were promoting it, saying ECW means anything goes. So I was just high on life at that point. I was like, oh, my God, now I got the best of everything. I'm on their stage in front of the world, but I get to be seen the way I want to be seen, like I was on the smaller stage of ECW, and I'm doing it, you know, with their blessing. And then, you know, that's why when I beat John Cena, it was like there was so much more going into that than just being the champion. It was because I did it my way. I brought back, I changed the whole playing field, and that was the only way that it was going to be possible that I would ever be the champion, and it was just all too good. I remember we had a SmackDown versus ECW show where I wrestled Rey Mysterio, and it still was Anything Goes, and it was just one of my favorite matches because I was like, boom, I'm going to do this, you know, boom, monkey flip him and then make him land on a chair, boom. Just there's so much more creativity that can be added when you add more elements, you know, like bringing a chair or whatever, and that's why, like, for me, it's just so much more fun doing it. So many more ways I can find to be different, to show what they haven't seen before, and to take a lot more punishment because that's something that I enjoy as well. So that match, great going into it, great. When we started the third brand of ECW, I had some awesome matches that I'm so glad were seen by that big of a crowd. I mean, I guess we were on Sci-Fi Channel or whatever, so it wasn't as many people, I'm sure, as the Monday night show, but those fans got to see what ECW was about when I was in the ring with Hardcore Holly, with Test, Sabu, of course, and, you know, some of those matches people still remember because they were so brutal, but that was exactly where I shine.
Yeah, I think it started out with a lot of potential, the third brand, the ECW brand. Of course, it was on Sci-Fi. But how quickly did you realize that they were going to change the concept? It was going to be more of a lower-level developmental league rather than an actual ECW brand at this?
First off, they were feeding other wrestlers into the ECW, which I hated. I hated that Bradshaw was on One Night Stand and the SmackDown crew was sitting up there because Vince didn't trust that we could pull the numbers in on our own. I hated that they were sending SmackDown and Raw guys to ECW, and it was blending and confusing the whole issue on, okay, who wrestles for which brand now? How is it going? I wanted, if they were going to do that, for ECW to be the forum for people to come to settle their scores with Extreme Rules. You know, I said, okay, cool. So if whatever, you know, Matt Hardy and Edge, if they're not part of ECW, but, you know, next Tuesday or whatever, Thursday or whatever, if they come to ECW to have Extreme Rules match, because that's just where their angle leads them, and now they got to do it with us, with the ECW guys, and where they're watching. Well, that's awesome. That's a great way to enhance and add depth to what ECW is about. Vince didn't like that at all because he's like, well, then we can't have hardcore matches. And then he said, I got to have rules. And rules? No, ECW means Anything Goes. If you have rules, you'll kill it all. And that's what he said to me, is I have to have credibility for my referees, Rob. You know, and who am I? I mean, I knew what was happening. He was going to destroy it, but who am I to tell him that I know what's better for a worldwide brand? I'm no billionaire, but I did know he was destroying the ECW, and apparently that was okay with him.
I don't know if you get a chance to really watch, you know, WWE now. You're obviously, you know, working
negative.
The other company.
I didn't even watch it when I was there.
Okay, so
I would watch my matches only when I was there. I would, like, fast forward to watch my match, and I'd watch it from a working perspective, you know, like, hey, I need to get my ass up faster if I'm going to do this, or I'm going to quit doing that, or maybe it'd be cool if I turned this way first. Just that. I'd study it. I don't enjoy actually watching the my fellow workers do their job.
So you didn't tune in to see the 1,000th episode of Raw?
That's correct.
Okay. What's your thoughts on Linda McMahon running for the U.S. Senate?
Well, I think the McMahons are trying to be all they can be. So, you know, good for them for that aspect of going out there and grabbing life. I would assume she must know a lot about politics in order to pursue that position, but I don't know enough about her. I don't know anything about her positions on anything, or I definitely can't comment on her qualification, but I'm impressed that you know, she's involved that much with the community to even pursue something like that. I mean, that's very impressive for anybody. I admire leadership, and there's certain people that look at it that way instead of looking at, like prior to when we started this interview, you know, we commented a little bit about some of the conspiracy theories with the government and stuff on the website that you've heard me talk about on RVD TV or on that what's the theory website you got?
Truth is scary.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I mean, a lot of people they like to just, you know, hide under their turtle shell and report and tell people, this is what they're doing. This is what they're doing. You know, stock up, you know, fill your closets with canned food and water, man, and wait for it to happen. And other people look at life like, you know what? This is our world. I'm going to go and make some changes. I'm going to, and those are leaders. Those are the people that stand forward to get people to work underneath them, to follow them. They're office position holders. They're whatever, even the godfathers of the mobster teams. I mean, you know what I mean? Like those, not that I'm condoning that kind of business, but I am a mob fan guy. And I just think like those people that go out there and make a change, you have to know so much about the current business world to not be intimidated, you know, to even cross that barrier and think about like, well, I don't know what kind of permits and taxes and zoning laws are required. Who knows? But whatever it takes. Why not you do it instead of somebody else? You know, you're both got the same life expectancy.
How is Sabu doing these days?
Sabu's doing really good these days. He's taking independent bookings and he's you know, hoping to get another chance somewhere, anywhere real soon. You know, in a big way, but yeah, a lot of people heard about some bad times that he went through recently. He's recovered from that. And he appears to have stopped his pursuing his old habits that have scared many of us for many, many years. He seems to be in a good place right now, mentally and physically, and he's now, you know, ready to try to either repair some damage or just move forward with his wrestling career.
Do you ever envision yourself ever working as a heel again?
I don't envision myself working as a heel. At this point in my career, if it did happen, I would feel like it's cashing in. You know, I would feel like it's the guys in the office saying, "Well, we don't know what else to do with you, Rob. So let's try this. Before you're done." Because I mean, like I said, I'm not going to be wrestling still in 10 years. You know, and it could be 5 years or less. I really don't know. But at this point, after being so popular and so loved for so many years, to all of a sudden turn like that, I wouldn't say never. But that's how I feel about it, though. I do get off on the energy from the fans, you know, screaming for me and holding the signs up, and the heels do get a lot of hate in and out of the ring. You know, people really like to get invested into the wrestling and stuff. I remember when I used to travel with some heels, and they would get even, you know, in restaurants and stuff, and they'd be like, "RVD, why are you with him? He's a dick." You know, and it's like, you know, that would probably get to me mentally. You know, I mean, would it still be worth it for the reason that we all do our jobs? You know, would it still be worth it for the money? Sure, bro. You know, I mean, whatever, it could be, but I don't see that as being the best way to use RVD. Now, it is fun, you know, being a bad guy. There's a lot of fun. You can have fucking with the crowd and the referee and just, you know, character-wise, that can be like, it can be fun, but, you know, I don't know, I'm kind of like doing what I'm doing right now, you know what I mean? I'm one of the only guys I think that hasn't been like repackaged and reinvented and renamed over and over, at least since Bill Watts called me Robbie V back in the WCW. So I like that too, you know what I mean? Like, we're doing it this long. I mean, if you want to shave me bald and give me tattoos right now, I mean, there goes my value.
What was your favorite title reign?
My favorite title reign, I suppose, was the ECW TV title reign, for the purpose of how much fun it was and how much I felt like the whole company was on my shoulders. I felt really comfortable with that. I loved the challenge of the responsibility that came with that. And the company was growing fast, and it was our style and our heart that was causing us to grow, and I had to do my best to be the leader of that pack, prospectively, and that's how I took it. You know, I like I was all, and a lot of fans will back me up on this. I was almost like a side attraction. Like there was ECW, and then there was the Rob Van Dam show. That's what it felt like. The fans would be cheering RVD sometimes from the beginning of the show through all the matches all the way till I came out. And for me, whether I was going to wrestle a monster like One Man Gang, Bam Bam Bigelow, Kamala, I mean, we'd bring guys in from Mexico, Japan, whatever, give them a shot at the title. And that was the story. I've always kind of, you know, not really like storylines either. I just want to go out there and do what I do. And something like the BFG tournament, something like, you know, just that ECW title reign and defending it, those were the stories. So any opponent that I would have, you know, that's all the reason you need to have for having that opponent. I loved it. Or I could be wrestling a little guy like Little Guido or Spec Dudley, whatever. I was going to try and steal the show. So I was going to go 30 minutes, whether it was in front of 200 people or 7,000 people. And I was going to, you know, just like me and the crowd were like partying together while I was in the ring. When I'd be bowing and they'd be like just going nuts off the hook, I'd be absorbing all that energy. So that's going to be my favorite for that reason. I mean, obviously, having the WWE World Championship and, like I said, having changed the playing field to obtain that my way, that was very, very rewarding. And for the rest of my life, I'll be reaping the rewards because my value as an entertainer in the business world goes up, you know, once I'm a world champion of that standard. So definitely thankful for that one as well.
Yeah, I you know, I've been to a lot of wrestling shows, house shows, you know, WWF, WWE, TNA, Ring of Honor. Nothing, I don't think anything will ever compare to the ECW days, the Paul Heyman ECW days. Just from the start of the show to the end of the show, the energy of the crowd, you know, they're popping for all their favorite stars, and they're into it to the main event, and then obviously at the main event they're still cheering. I don't know, you know, when you've wrestled for WWE, TNA, you know, even independently, is there any, it's just like a special period. Has any crowd ever come close to that ECW crowd?
No, and they won't ever. You know, thank God for DVDs. Everybody, I get asked more than any other night. I get asked about that one night stand when I beat John Cena for the title, and particularly because of the crowd at the Manhattan ballroom. It was insane. 100% of that crowd wanted John Cena to go down. And everybody remembers the sign, if Cena wins, we riot. That was just legendary, you know. Thank God for DVDs, because that'll never happen again. But definitely a night out of my career because of the crowd and it by itself that I'll always remember, that I'm thankful. That was definitely a great experience.
Is there anything left for you to accomplish in wrestling?
I don't think there's – if there's something left to accomplish, then I don't know what it is. I mean, I kind of feel like at this point, I don't feel like there's something that I personally have to go for right now. It's a job that I enjoy. The fans sometimes will complain about whether I'm being utilized the right way or not. I think for the most part, that's for the fans to complain about. You know, I'm there doing what I can do, doing my job. And is it possible that one day again that I'll feel like the whole business is on my shoulders and that I'm the man in the spotlight and that I have, you know, legions of fans around the world counting on me to do something momentous that'll bring the business into a whole new direction? Could happen, could not.
As far as the future, maybe writing a book, or would you consider possibly running a wrestling school?
A wrestling school doesn't interest me at this point. Over the years, I have tried it. I've actually had I've started like some little ones here or there, or done some classes. I don't have the patience for it. I think I'm a better doer than teacher when it comes to some of my physical gifts. I think might be more natural than something that I learned. And even if I can understand it, I can't make somebody else do it. Besides, as I talked about with transitions, when there's so much outside of wrestling that I want to do and that I am doing. ton of stuff that I'm not even, you know, ready to talk about. However, it does absorb some of my energy and time every single day. Definitely I want to write an autobiography. Currently I'm writing a fiction novel, and that's going to take a long time. And when I'm done with that, I have a screenplay, also fiction, that I'm going to be writing, and that's going to take a long time. And the autobiography will definitely have to come after that. But I have all these other projects also that I'm dealing with. So one thing that I'm getting better at is delegating and thereby growing my team, and that's allowing stuff to get done faster, which is why I do have some stuff to show at that website, robvandam.com. So everything's moving forward, and definitely someday I want to tell the autobiography, because you know for sure I'm not going to be lying about anything. I'll be very candid and open. You know what I mean? I want to be remembered for the truth. And even whatever this guy died from, I want everyone to know that's what I died from, so they don't you know, find the same downfall if that's a possibility or whatever. I don't understand when people try to, you know, oh come on, just give them rest, or just, you know, just let the family, whatever. I mean, I'm all about I'm living the story right now, and you know, this is the true story. So people that are interested in that, they need to know that, not a twisted up version of you know, what's more politically correct.
Have you given any thought? Obviously, this is after you're retiring. After you would retire, you know, totally, to maybe going to the Hall of Fame, WWE's Hall of Fame. Have you given that any thought, or is that nothing that I can't say you wouldn't think about? But is it important to you that someday you get honored and you are put into the WWE Hall of Fame?
It would be a great honor. It's not something that I expect. I don't have any idea if I would qualify or not by whoever makes the standards for that, you know, would make that decision. So I'd be very, very surprised, but also, of course, honored. I mean, that'd be super cool.
Do you think in your lifetime they'll ever legalize marijuana?
Absolutely. We have like 17 states with medicinal programs, plus the District of Columbia right now. Not to mention, before 100 years ago or so, it was legal everywhere. But Colorado actually looks like very promising to go through this year to legalize it, like alcohol for adults on a recreational purpose. We tried with Proposition 19 here in California, and it was really close, 56% to 54%, I believe. We tried in Nevada a few years ago, and it was very close too. And polls are showing that over 50% of the voters in Colorado want to legalize marijuana. There's like 40% against it and 10% undecided, but I happen to know there's quite a budget going into promoting the pros of this, and not much opposition against it yet. So Colorado might be the first to set the standards. And if so, of course, the feds will come in and they will sue the state. They will appeal the election. They'll do something, because the feds want you to believe that marijuana is the most dangerous drug, a Schedule I, with no medicinal value. Whereas look up cocaine or meth, and they'll tell you, according to the federal guidelines, that that's higher in medicinal value and safer for you, a Schedule II. That these are the kind of things that if people really knew that that's the truth, then I think that it would change. That's all it would take to change it. You know, if they knew that it's impossible to overdose from marijuana, it simply is not near toxic enough. Not even near. You'd have to smoke like 12 pounds of it in under 20 minutes or something, which nobody can do, to get the toxic level to cause death. If people knew that, that would be a change too. But they're looking more and more into the medicinal properties. They also, for argument's sake, need to realize recreationally it's safer than any alternatives, but also materially. I mean, we could be making everything, including fuel, including fuel, which Henry Ford wanted you to know. You can make fuel from hemp seed, and you can run cars on it and everything, but the systems aren't set up for that. That's why it's prohibited right now. So it's like the current systems, which are run by evil profit and greed, and it destroys the earth, but it is the way our system is. You can't all of a sudden turn a river backwards, and I know that. But morally and logically, and soon on an education level, Americans are going to know enough to put their thoughts into it, and then we will see a change.
If nothing else, you know, turn off NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, Fox News. I mean, you just get so much misinformation. It's amazing to me that, you know, alcohol is glorified in this country, and yet, you know, they demonize marijuana. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, and they actually
bring
in close to the same amount of money on a national level too, which is funny considering the billions of dollars behind promoting alcohol at every sporting event, in every single magazine, you know, sponsoring every boxing match, compared to $0 promoting marijuana. But it still brings in about the same because, and when I say about the same, we're off by, I think alcohol brings in $135 billion and marijuana like $114 billion according to studies. Pretty close though. But the thing about that people might not realize is that, and by the way, I want to put out there, I don't want kids to smoke pot, and I always I need the proper platform to say that. You know, it's not like there's a big difference between somebody that's educated on the benefits of cannabis and some kid in junior high that wants to stand on his head and do gravity hits. You know what I mean? And unfortunately, it's easier for most people to just lump it all together and then say, Doritos, and then get everybody to laugh the whole thing off. But it really is a problem because so many people are arrested for it. And here in L.A., in California, where, you know, we were the leaders with the medicinal program, there actually is a ban. L.A. County is going to try and shut down like 900 dispensaries. And so there's appeals to that because you know what happens then? All the patients, because we have a lot of patients here, and people can argue about, you know, who actually needs the pot or not. One thing you got to know, it's a doctor that recommends it. And also the feds tell you nobody needs it. Not the cancer patients, not the AIDS patients, not people dying, not people suffering from pain and wasting away from diseases and not being able to eat. Feds say, no, pot's no good. There's no medicinal value. Oh, by the way, we've manufactured this THC pill that's 100% THC. This will be good for you. You just got to buy it through our pharmaceutical companies. That's what the federal government does for you. But the point I wanted to make about the annual sales that people need to know is that marijuana in the United States is our number one cash crop. It brings in more than twice the number of all vegetables combined. How about that?
Wow. That's, again, that's things you're not going to hear in the media.
You're not going to eradicate it. It's not going anywhere. The whole war on pot is a waste of lives, and we need to legalize it, regulate it, and, you know, let's get some tax out of it, keep the money above ground.
Who do you support for president?
At this point, I'm not a supporter of anybody, so I have to I can't name either one right now. I'm disappointed in everybody, and I know it's kind of a cop-out kind of thing to say, but I can't really say that I'm supporting anybody right now.
At one point you were supporting Ron Paul.
I love Ron Paul, and I do support everything. I love the guy. He's genuine. Everything, you know, that he says, you can tell that he believes it. You know, he's thinking about the questions. He's not just running off brainwashed answers or response that he's been training for. He thinks about the questions, but also everything that he stands on is good too. I even forget to mention him because right now everyone's just talking about, you know, Romney and Obama.
Yeah. How do you enjoy the pat downs by the TSA?
Well, it's kind of necessary. It can be a pain in the ass sometimes, you know, but I fly a lot. And I have I have my own systems. You know, they have something now called a pre-check. And because I fly so much, the airports and the terminals that offer pre-check let me go through this lane where I don't take my shoes off. I don't even have to take liquids out or my laptop out of my bag. You just basically like walk right through as if they've already checked you before you've gotten to the airport. Not really sure how they're keeping the terrorists from using the pre-check, but I love it. It saves a lot of time.
I figured you might have a system. Somebody travels as much as you do.
Yeah, and even in the terminals that don't have the pre-check, you know, I mean, I know the system pretty much, and it's, so I get through it probably a lot swifter than most people. But it still can be a pain in the ass, especially if I'm in an airport and the line looks like it's in, you know, 9/13, meaning like 2 days after 9/11 happened. That happened a couple of weeks ago. I remember where I was, but the line was so fucking long. I actually, it was in Pittsburgh, and I actually missed my flight, which I haven't done in a long time, and it pissed me off. But it was, yeah, I mean, you know, I get standards since I fly so much. Who wouldn't? You get standards of everything that happens in a day. You know, your daily expectations are your standards. And after going through, and it's smooth, this town's smooth, no problem, bam, what the fuck is wrong with these people? What the hell? They let the airport get like this? I hate this town. Yeah, it's feeling like that.
How is your wife doing?
She's doing awesome. She's healthy for 4 years now, and she's got all kinds of goals and agendas of herself that she's pursuing with a photography career.
That's awesome. Well, RVD, we appreciate your time. I could ask you another million questions, but maybe we'll hook up again some other time. And I know you're a busy person. Why don't you get and plug your website, what you have coming up, your road schedule, personal appearances that you'll be making. And I know you're also on social media as well.
Yes, I did take to Twitter recently. I had like 100,000 followers at The Real RVD, and then I got inspired to start using it. And I found it addictive because I travel by myself on the road, and Twitter is often my companion. And you know, it's a useful tool to keep in communication. I get asked the same questions over and over and over, so, you know, obviously I'm not going to respond to everybody, but that's The Real RVD, and I try to make robbandam.com the hub always, where you can everything can connect there. So if you go there, that'll take you to my RVD TV episodes, which I haven't done a new one in forever. We're still recovering some of the old ones, but eventually I'll start doing them again. I do the RVD radio sporadically. I got audio blogs and written blogs on there, and if you go to the RVD Productions, I have two projects that have actually seen the light of day recently, and one of them is my comic book that I wrote. It's called Twisted Perception. If you go to RVD Productions off of robvandam.com, you'll see it, or you can go to robvandam.com/twistedperception, whatever. But it's a big like 136-page book. I wrote it and had you know, I had some people like draw it up, and I oversaw like every single step of it. And this is a pre-published book. I went ahead and printed it up, but I have a contract with a publisher that will be putting it out at a later date. I just, I'm still working out the contract, so it'll be a collector's edition. I happen to know they're going to cut it in half and make it 96 pages, and it's me and my creativity, my characters, one of my personalities, and it's something I'm very passionate about. Also, I have a clothing logo at platypieproductions.org, which you can also get to off of robvandam.com. And our first logo, the nonconformity logo, is there. It's available in like T-shirts and tank tops and ball cap. I've worn it a couple of times on TV. You might have seen it, but soon to follow will be more logos and more to put it on and stuff, and a bunch of other projects as well. So robvandam.com is the hub. Appreciate you letting me get it out there. You can see my Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff from there. And as I said, send me the link to this, and you'll even be able to listen to this interview at robvandam.com.
Well, I'm looking forward to that, and I do appreciate you doing the interview with us today. I really enjoy robvandam.com. I definitely will recommend it. Well, of course, we'll plug robvandam.com, your Twitter, and your Facebook on our website when we put this interview up, so we do appreciate it. We do appreciate your time, Rob. Thank you very much. Keep up the great work. We do enjoy watching you in the ring still. Never gets old. We're always amazed at what you can do in that ring. So we wish you all the best, and hopefully we'll talk to you real soon.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. Have a great day. Talk to you soon.